morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Batty in Washington. Today is Tuesday, October 12, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The International Court of Justice is expected to deliver its verdict today on a disputed maritime border between Kenya and Somalia.
The delivery of the judgment will be the culmination of a flawed judicial process that Kenya has had reservations with and withdrawn from.
Four-time Uganda presidential candidate Dr. Kizza Besigye says he's not surprised that the government has dropped a five-year-old treason charge against him. Some recommendations for Africa to mitigate the effects of climate change. A call to investigate allegations of corruption at the Ghana Electoral Commission. And the European Union imposes temporary visa restrictions on the Gambia.
As a government, we are properly digesting this report. Hopefully, we will come to the understanding what it properly means and also some of the responses that could be generated from them.
And a group of health experts recommend a 70% full global vaccination against COVID-19 by mid-2022. Those stories and more coming up on Daybreak Africa. The International Court of Justice, the ICJ, is expected to deliver its verdict on the disputed maritime border between Somalia and Kenya today, Tuesday. The ruling is expected to resolve the dispute over a 30,000 square nautical miles of territory in the Indian Ocean with prospects of vast oil and gas deposits. Kenya and Somalia are fighting for ownership of the territory. As Maureen Ojiambo reports from Milwaukee, USA, Kenya has made it clear that it will not recognize nor respect the court's ruling.
Following a maritime border dispute, Somalia instituted proceedings against Kenya at the International Court of Justice, ICJ, in August 2014. After long-failed efforts to have the two countries resolve their dispute, Kenya has vowed not to honor today's ruling. Kenya's Foreign Affairs Permanent Secretary Macharia Kamau said that the ICJ court lacks jurisdiction to determine the dispute.
The first threat to Kenya's territorial integrity was overt and direct. That happened during the Shifter War of 1967-1969. We remain resolute and steadfast in the same commitment today.
A few weeks ago, Kenya walked out of the court and maintains that the ICJ cannot deliver fair judgment, accusing the court of unfairness. Ambassador Kamau said that Kenya will not respect the verdict despite the outcome of the ruling.
The delivery of the judgment will be the culmination of a flawed judicial process that Kenya has had reservations with and withdrawn from on account not just of its obvious and inherent bias, but also of its unsuitability to resolve the dispute at hand. Whichever way it decides will have profound security, political, social, and economic ramifications in our region and beyond.
The local Kenyans who gain from the waters through fishing have since held demos asking the government to protect its territory for economic benefits. Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta visit to Lamu military base, not far away from the disputed land, said that the country will not give up any part of its territory, either to Somalia or any other neighboring country.
We shall not accept anyone to say that they claim some parts of our country. We know our borders and we respect other people's borders. And it is required of others to respect borders. Those who think that we are not ready to protect our borders should know that that is a dream.
The maritime dispute has strained diplomatic relations between Kenya and Somalia over accusations and counter-accusations about interference with domestic affairs, territorial integrity, trade and security. International affairs expert Professor Macharia Munene says there could be conflict between the two states after the ruling.
The decision by the ICJ, if it is fair, would have listened to Kenya's argument. It repeatedly failed to accommodate and seemingly did things in favor of a Somali-dominated court. The matter might go to the UN Security Council as the next possible level, but there are also possibilities of conflict escalating a little bit.
The ruling is eagerly awaited, particularly by Somalia, which has repeatedly rejected pressure from Kenya and African Union for a diplomatic resolution to the prolonged dispute. Kenya has already rejected the ruling before the verdict is made, and it will be interesting to see next steps that she will take in the event they lose the case. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Moreno Jiambo in Milwaukee, USA.
In Uganda, four-time presidential candidate Dr. Kizza Besigye says he is not surprised by reports that the government has secretly dropped a five-year treason charge against him. Besigye says Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni uses criminal charges as a tool for persecution of his political opponents. Dr. Besigye was charged with treason following the 2016 presidential election for allegedly swearing himself in as president of Uganda on the eve of President Museveni swearing in. The Uganda Daily Monitor reported on Monday that the Director of Public Prosecutions dropped the charge in 2019. Besigye tells me that he stands by his decision to swear himself in as president because he won the 2016 election. He says the government dropped the treason charges because they were trumped up and could not withstand the initial test of a prima facie case.
James, this charge, according to the report that appeared in the papers today, which was my first time to know anything about it, was apparently dropped 2 years ago. I was never informed. My lawyers have never been informed. Apparently, it was just secretly dropped. And this happened because there was no charge to begin with. Here, criminal charges are the despot's tool for political persecution, the despot's tool for crippling political opponents. And so it's not surprising at all that this charge has also been dropped in that way.
The treason charge against you that is being reported, Dr. Besigye, was the one brought against you, I think, for you swearing yourself in as the president of Uganda. That was in 2016. Do you stand by that decision, or where are you now?
While the case was still going on in court, I told the court that it was true. I declared myself the winner of the presidential elections and that there was nothing, therefore, for the prosecution to claim to investigate, since I am in court and saying I declared myself. What was needed was that the trial begins and I present evidence of my having won the election. I still contend to this day that I won that election. I have evidence to prove that I won the election, and that is clearly why that case could not be taken to trial. So I'm not surprised that later on they secretly dropped the charges.
What do you think is behind the decision to drop the charge?
James, you must understand that I have been arraigned in court over countless number of charges in the last 20 years that I have been contesting and challenging the dictatorial regime of General Museveni. In all the cases that I have been charged with, not a single one have I ever been required to defend myself in court, to present a defense. All of them have been dismissed without the need to defend myself. In other words, they were patently trumped up charges that could not withstand the initial test of proving a prima facie case in a court that requires the response of a defendant. So this is not any different. This case, this trumped up treason charge, was of a similar category. That's why I'm not surprised at all that they secretly dropped the charges.
Just recently, I think it was last week, Dr. Besigye, you and other political leaders formed a new pressure group. What can you tell us about this group, particularly what is it expected to accomplish?
Yes, James, what happened last week was that all the various change-seeking political parties, political pressure groups, individuals that have been political actors or political activists for democratic change in Uganda, human rights activists, rallied together to work for a transition from gun rule to a democratic dispensation. It will be recalled that in Uganda, since independence, and we celebrated 59 years of independence last weekend, in all these 59 years, no leader has ever handed over power peacefully to another leader. Every leader has had to be bombed out of office, and whoever has occupied government office in Uganda has had to bomb their way into office. So we live under gun rule, and our coming together is aimed at taking steps that can lead to a transition from gun rule to democratic governance. That's why it is called the People's Front for Transition, transition from gun rule to democratic governance.
Dr. Kizza Besigye is a four-time Ugandan presidential candidate. He was speaking with us from the capital, Kampala. The European Union has imposed what it called temporary visa restrictions on the Gambia. This followed the Gambian government's failure to accept Gambian nationals who had been declared unwelcome in European countries. As Pandere Umbai reports from Raleigh, North Carolina, thousands of Gambian migrants are ready to be deported from Europe, especially from Germany.
The European Union has slammed the Gambian government with visa restrictions. The optional visa fee waiver for holders of Gambian diplomatic and service passports have been suspended, according to the EU. Such passport holders would henceforth be required to pay visa fees. The EU has also suspended the 15 days visa processing period, meaning that visa applicants would wait for a long time before their applications would be decided. Multiple entry visas have also been suspended, the EU said. Ibrahim Asilla is Gambia's information minister.
We have also received the press release issued by the European Union delegation to the Gambia on the issue of temporal visa measures for nationals of the Gambia under the EU visa code. As they call it. As a government, we are properly digesting this report. Hopefully, we will come to the understanding what it properly means and also some of the responses that could be generated from them.
The EU visa sanction followed the Gambia government's alleged failure to receive its nationals who have been lined up to be deported from different European countries. The EU notes that under international law, all countries have the sovereign right to decide who can enter and stay on their territory, as well as the obligation to readmit their nationals. It further notes that individuals who have no right to stay in the member states of the EU must return to their home country in a dignified way, in full respect of fundamental human rights.
The issue of migration, of course, is a contentious issue in the region where we are. But that notwithstanding, these are people that actually are Gambians. It is not the wish of any country to reject your own nationals anyway, and that is not the position of the Gambia government.
The new visa restrictions would last for 6 months, upon which the EU says a review would follow.
Well, you know, I mean, Gambia is not also responsible for how the other countries react when it comes to their foreign policy. However, it is the wish of the Gambia that we continue that very strong, cordial relationship with all the countries, including the EU.
The EU is calling on the Gambian government to fulfill its international obligation by accepting to receive their own nationals living in EU countries without legal papers. For VOA Daybreak Africa, this is Pandering by reporting from Raleigh, North Carolina.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, October 12. Care for Free and Fair Elections Ghana, a political pressure group, is calling on the newly installed special prosecutor to investigate allegations of corruption at the Electoral Commission. The group says the special prosecutor should also invite people to present evidence of alleged electoral malpractices during the 2020 presidential and legislative elections. David Kumi Ado is the executive director of CARE Ghana. He tells viewers Peter Clotte that the transparent investigation into allegations of corruption and the prosecution of those who violated the laws governing elections will help restore confidence in the Electoral Commission's ability to administer credible future polls.
The special prosecutor in an interview indicated that his office has the mandate to investigate and prosecute any member of the Electoral Commission that will tamper with election results or rig elections for any political party or candidate. It was a welcoming news. What we're actually telling the special prosecutor is that there were allegations of electoral malpractices, tampering of election results, and changing of election figures in the 2020 election. So if he wants Ghanaians to take him serious, then he should start his investigation with the 2020 election so that Ghanaians will take his word serious, but not just mere threats. So basically, that's what we are calling on the special prosecutor to do.
Do you think people will be forthcoming to present that kind of evidence to the special prosecutor?
We have enough evidence to assist the special prosecutor in his investigation and then subsequently prosecution. I am also aware that many Ghanaians have also indicated that they are willing and ready if only the special prosecutor needs he's furious about the things he said, then they'll be willing and ready to provide the special prosecutor with some assistance with information that will help the special prosecutor do its work. Now, the conversation in Ghana here is that the 2024 elections is going to be a do-or-die affair. And this is simply as a result of the loss of confidence and trust that people have gotten for the Electoral Commission. So we believe that if the special prosecutor actually wades into this matter and prosecute people who will be found guilty or culpable, that will actually impose an enormous confidence and trust in the special prosecutor and then the Electoral Commission.
But David, some are suggesting that those who are asking for an investigation on allegations of procurement violations are just those who lost the elections, just want to create mischief. And that is why they are calling for that. And that there's nothing untoward. Both local and international poll observers describe Ghana's recent elections as free, fair, credible, and transparent. How do you respond to that?
We are ordinary Ghanaians. We believe that it is our responsibility to ensure that our elections are conducted in a free and fair and transparent manner. You know what is happening in Guinea as we speak today. You know what's happening in Mali as we speak today. We don't want our country, our beloved country, to travel that path. That is why it is very important. Now, even what we are calling for the special prosecutor to do, a lot of countries do them. There is post-election assessment that UK engages in after every election. South Africa also engages in the post-election assessment. Sierra Leone engages in the post-election assessment. And Guyana, these are countries that engage in post-election assessment to assess the processes that led to the election, so that you can look whether there are some flaws with the processes and the strength in the processes. So we can propose some recommendations we believe that can help strengthen our electoral processes.
David Kumi Ado is the executive director of CARE for Free and Fair Elections Ghana. You are speaking with VOA's Peter Clotte. A new report lays out how individual countries can mitigate climate change through different approaches to land use. One of the report authors, Stephanie Rowe, an environmental scientist with Climate Focus, tells Ricky Stryak that in sub-Saharan Africa, the two main mitigation activities that were identified are protection of forests and other ecosystems such as wetlands and improved agricultural practices.
Obviously, there's a big profile of different types of countries in Africa and the Western African regions and Central African regions like DRC and Nigeria, Cameroon, etc., have very high potential for protection of forests. Africa has some of the largest primary forests remaining in the world, and being able to protect those forests presents really, really high mitigation efficiency, or what we call in the report as high mitigation density, which is total mitigation per area unit is the highest in protecting forests. In terms of the agriculture profile and sequestering carbon, there's a large potential in a lot of more arid regions. So, for example, South Africa, Ethiopia, Sudan, etc., have very high potential for in improving soil carbon sequestration in croplands and pasturelands. And that also has brings with it a lot of additional benefits related to improving or boosting fertility in the soils and also enhancing resilience to climate change.
Does your report look at how countries can do this while also making sure that the people in those countries have the things they need and want, such as education and healthcare?
Of course. And I mean, the thing with land-based mitigation measures is that it can be done well and done in tandem with a lot of the sustainable development goals, or it can be done poorly and directly compete with those goals, right? And so, you know, obviously you want a situation where you do the former, which is you try to mitigate climate, but you also try to deliver on these other goals, such as ensuring food security, improving infrastructure, you know, general development of the region. A lot of these mitigation measures can do that, because if you deforest, for example, the entire Congo Basin or continue to deforest the Western African forest, has major impacts on rain cycles, for example, which will impact agriculture and agricultural yields.
Can you identify a couple of countries, one where the potential is there, and then of course, you know, what are the challenges for other countries? You mentioned DRC.
I think the biggest challenges within most of the countries are in finance and in governance. Land governance spans a lot. And so it's forests, it's agriculture, it's basically, it's all the natural ecosystems. And that touches on a lot of different government bodies. It also touches a lot of people, millions of farmers, forest communities, indigenous peoples. To scale up action, you need to address these barriers by addressing the kind of the weak governance and lack of finance. DRC is I think, doing a lot to improve on that. And in their national climate plan, they provide, you know, what they can do by themselves and then what they can do with additional support, international support. And a lot of these countries do the same. And so I think it is incumbent upon the international community to help developing countries, particularly those in Africa, that can help mitigate climate, but also help deliver on some of those goals in the sustainable development goals, like addressing food security.
That was Stephanie Rowe, an environmental scientist with Climate Focus. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Virginia, USA. A group of World Health Organization experts is calling for 70% of the global population to be fully vaccinated by mid-2022 to prevent the COVID-19 pandemic from progressing in more dangerous ways. The 15-member strategic advisory group of experts, known as SAGE, which makes recommendations to WHO on vaccine policy and strategy, just concluded a four-day meeting. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The experts say more than enough vaccines are available to cover everyone by the middle of next year if the doses are not hoarded by wealthy countries and are shared equitably with poorer nations, which, as of yet, do not have them. WHO Director of Immunization Vaccines and Biologicals, Catherine O'Brien, says it is urgent to get the doses to places that are falling behind in the race to vaccinate.
And unless we do that, we will continue to have transmission, and transmission will lead to more variants. And the issue of the variants is that there is the potential for those variants to escape immune pressure and to basically undo much of the progress that has been made.
The experts recommend people who are moderately and severely immune compromised should be offered an additional or third dose of all COVID-19 vaccines. O'Brien says the third dose should be administered 1 to 3 months after people have received their second shot.
The intent of the third dose is to induce that person's immune system to have protection that would be at the level that was demonstrated to prevent against severe disease, hospitalization, and death in the clinical trials, which excluded people with immunocompromising conditions.
The SAGE experts say these additional shots are different from booster shots, which are not needed at this stage of the pandemic. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And that's it for this Tuesday, October 12th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Reiki Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, I'm James Butte in Washington.